Now, back to Paul Harris
on the Voice of St. Louis,
KMOX.
That is the music that means it's football on CBS. And there's a very good chance that after that music starts up, at some point you're going to hear the following voice. The voice that belongs to a man who has been a sportscaster for 50 years. He has won 13 Emmys. He's been named National Sportscaster of the Year 9 times. The two-word phrase, oh my, belongs to him. He is Dick Enberg, joining me here on the Paul Harris Show. Hello, Dick.
Oh, my, Paul. It's an honor to be on KMOX. That's such a storied sports station. You think there's only a couple like it in the entire country. I think of WJR in Detroit, a clear channel station that has long been the station to carry Michigan and Detroit Lion and Detroit Tiger games. And KMOX with, boy, when you think about the Hall of Fame announcers that have come through your station, I'm honored to be aboard.
Did you know Jack Buck?
I did know Jack and loved the man, as we all did. I don't think there's ever been a better master of ceremonies, whether you're talking about sports or politics or art or music, than Jack. He had a way with bringing the person in the back row right up with him on the dais. I can recall when we inducted Jack into the Sportscasters Hall of Fame in New York, and his wife was aboard, and I'm sure many fans in St. Louis have heard all of his great humor, and I won't try to repeat that, but he said something I wish I had. He recounted a moment where his wife had said to him, what if God came back and you had a chance to tell him one thing? What, Jack, would you tell him? And Buck said, I would ask him, why have you been so good to me?
Mm.
And that really summarizes the man, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Absolutely. Well, you've had a pretty good life yourself. You write in the book about how pretty much you're living out the fantasy life.
Well, I have for 50 years, rubbing shoulders with greatness. Goodness. This weekend I'll do a game for CBS in Indiana. We'll have the Michigan State-Indiana game, and I will get to meet with coaches and players that someday may be even more important than they are now in football season. I feel a little uncomfortable today because Dan Dierdorf isn't here at my side. Actually, I can reveal this to your audience. Don't tell anyone else.
Okay.
I just move my lips. He does my voice. it's been great fun for 5 years to work with Dan, who's so doggone bright and sees more than most of the analysts, all of them put together, and has fun and that great infectious laugh of his. And you know, football season is just over, but I already look forward to working again with him next fall.
You know, I think I know this, but having listened to you and Dierdorf for all these years, I think you guys have more fun in a blowout game than you do in a close game. Am I wrong?
Well, no, you're not wrong, Paul. And in fact, you know, not that we root for that, because as you know, the announcers are about, they're perceived to be good when the game is good. And if you have a great game, an overtime game or a one-point game, it all rubs off on the announcers. And even the critics then want to say, gee, what a great broadcast that was. And they pick out the good things that announcers say. Then you get a blowout game that is 46-10, much as the Super Bowl game that I did back when the Bears beat the New England Patriots, that Mike Ditka team. That's when you really have to work, but in many ways, that's when you have the most fun, because the preparation for any broadcast is overload. Dan has material that he'll never use. I have sheets and sheets on my spotting boards and notes that I'd like to use, and in a good game, you might be able to duck in about 10% of the material, but in a bad game, you'll use about 50%, and so it's kind of a negative approach to our business. We really do all that preparation in case there's a bad game, that we have some humorous material, historical material, maybe take a detour down the road and have a little more fun than you normally would. You take the and get away from the game and maybe extend a story through a couple, three plays where you're not really going to annoy the audience because the game has already been decided. And I really think that that's where we should be judged. And I do agree with you that Dan and I have a great time then because all the ties are cut off. We're not bound in any way. We can let it fly.
And how much of that is also because of the people who are in the production truck feeding you stuff and taking shots of oddball stuff? It's like okay, we don't have to pay 100% attention to the game right now. We can really have more fun. Are they part of that too?
Oh, absolutely. And they know in part some of the things that we might be talking about. We give them our shot list of, in case it is a blowout game, here are some things I'd like to talk about. Dan does the same thing. But part of the fun, too, is not knowing the shot they're going to take. And in a moment, though, they might even say, stand by, coming up in 3 seconds, react to this one. Well, that's kind of the fun. You don't know what you're going to get. But between Dan and myself, we usually can have a lot of fun and hopefully enhance the moment.
Now, you've done a lot of major events, not only all the Grand Slam tennis events and Super Bowls and World Series, but Olympics and even oddball sports. What is the hardest sports event to broadcast as a play-by-play man?
Oh, that's easy, Paul. And in fact, Ted Williams, who is the final chapter, as you saw, and he was my idol, and I thought it was a way, at least for a young reader of the book, to be inspired by my dreams and how my dreams took me to a terrific place. I didn't get to play right field as I hoped in the major leagues, but I got to meet my idol. I got to talk about him. He got to know me, and then late in life, when he came back to San Diego, where I live and where he grew up, he would call and ask me to go out for breakfast or lunch, and I'd be able to sit down and talk baseball with my idol. It would be comparable to the young people of many years ago who are now my age who had Stan Musial as their idol. And for Stan to say, hey, come on over, I want to talk to you, kid, that really completed the cycle. And Ted came roaring into a restaurant. Ted, with that big voice of his, when he asked you a question, it wasn't as if he wanted to know the answer. He thought he knew the answer. So he would say, hey, Yenberg, what is the toughest broadcast of sport to broadcast? And I said, Ted, it's yours. Baseball is by far the most difficult. No, it's got to be one of those, like hockey or basketball. That's got to be tougher. I said, no way. It's baseball because in a three-hour broadcast, you may have only 10 or 12 outstanding moments. It's what do you do with the rest of the time? And I've always contended that any man that can do baseball well on radio, and certainly your city has been blessed by, well, Jack Buck and, of course, before him, Harry Carey, and on down the line. Anyone who can do baseball well can do any other sport. That's the real litmus test for the professional talent. Baseball draws out more. It's the longest season. It's the most intimate game. You have more contact with players and managers than you do any other sport. But you have to be able on radio to, you know, that's a empty canvas as you start each broadcast, and you've got to paint the entire picture. And sometimes the pitcher won't throw the ball, and sometimes the batter won't stand in the batter's box. And now what do you do with all the downtime? That's there's the artistry.
Yeah, especially in a game with no clock, unlike the other sports. They'll take their time sometimes, and you know, there's not all that much game being played over the course of 3 hours, but you've got to fill the time nonetheless.
Well, but it's Shakespearean, and I try to explain to my friends who don't care much for baseball, you're probably trying to look for too much. You know, sure, there's nine guys on each side, but once you understand that the game basically is a two-man sport, it's batter against pitcher, pitcher against batter, then all the rest are complementary players, and they tell you some things about the game with their subtle movement during the course of a nine-inning game. But ultimately, it comes down to how a pitcher tries to set up a batter tries to set up a hitter. The catcher, of course, would get the supporting actor role in all this. And in my experience, definitely the single most exciting, dramatical opportunity for a play-by-play announcer in any sport is to call a no-hit, no-run game. There's nothing like it. The drama, once you get to that seventh inning and there's still zeros up on the board and there may be a possible no-hitter, and now you get to the eighth inning, and now every subtle movement in the dugout or an infielder shift or a catcher might mean the difference between that no-hitter or one being spoiled. And then you get to the ninth inning, and then the ultimate climax, when it happens, it's drama in sports at its very highest. And I would wish that for any broadcaster if they could have just one time to sink their teeth into a no-hit, no-run broadcast.
To me, one of the things that marks somebody as a true broadcaster, which to me is the highest compliment you can give anybody in radio or television, to call them a broadcaster, and you certainly are one. You have certainly strived to and thrived at your ability to be a wordsmith. So here's the perspective I'd like to hear from you. You know you're in the midst of a no-hit game or a perfect game, or you're driving to a Super Bowl, or you're going to an Olympic event where something truly historic may occur. How much are you, Dick Enberg, prepared with what you're going to say should this certain thing happen? How many of those words, how many of those lines have you either written down or mentally scripted?
Yeah, that's really an interesting question, Paul. It puts me on the spot, and I think in some ways you wish you would know in advance so you could script out some terrific prose. But I think the honest call, the reaction to the moment in the arena brings out the proper emotion. Sometimes if you over-prepare and you want to say, okay, one of these four guys is going to win a major golf tournament, or this woman is about to win her third straight Wimbledon, let me see what I could script out here. So if she wins, I'll just go to that copy and cap off the moment. It might be material and words that someone will say the best words of the week in their column, but on the other hand, is it really honest to the audience or to the moment? And maybe raw emotion and without thinking about it gives the viewer or the listener a better feel for it. Sometimes the best thing to say is nothing, to let the picture tell the words and let the emotion of fans and the star of the moment and the opposing team. Lord Byron couldn't write to some of those pictures that we see at the end of a World Series or at the end of a Super Bowl.
Are there times when you finish a broadcast or a game or that moment has passed even while you're still on the air and you say to yourself, oh, Dick, you should have said this or that, or something comes to you and you say, why didn't I say that?
You know too much, Paul. I mean that every game, just every game you do it, you're driving home and you say, oh, I had that great. In fact, the game last week at Michigan, we had Indiana at Michigan. And Courtney Sims, the 6'11 center for the University of Michigan, you don't see in many players' bios the fact that they were an outstanding, in fact, a champion tennis player in their youth. And Sims, when he was in junior high school, was 6'2 and was rated one of the top tennis players in New England. And I talked to him. He said Pete Sampras was my favorite. And now he likes Roger Federer. And he told me he was a two-handed backhand. And even though he had a big serve, he didn't come in behind it, didn't serve in volley. Now, there was some pretty good angles there when you see this big guy at 6'11 standing at the free throw line and told a little tennis information. You can't say that about many guys playing basketball. And that, you know, either the moment wasn't there or I missed it, and as soon as it was over, I thought, oh, I had that story, and I never ducked it in, and I may not have Michigan again this year.
So. and you can't go back to it 3 games later. Hey, remember when I was calling that game? It's
That's
gone.
Right. By the way, if you missed the game 3 weeks ago, I had this story about Courtney Sims. The other very poignant moment, and I still rue the day, and I mentioned it in the book, Kay Yao was the a women's basketball coach in 1988 in the Olympic Games in Seoul. And a couple of years, when she was named the head coach a couple of years before the games themselves, she went through the mandatory physical examination, and they found that she had breast cancer. And I know she's had a recurrence here of late, and our prayers and best hopes go with her, of course. And when she came out of the operation and the treatment, somebody was interviewing Kayao, and her comment regarding the whole incident was, when life gives you a kick, make sure it kicks you forward. Isn't that beautiful?
That is great.
And at the Olympics, I'm calling the gold medal game, and the United States wins, and there's Kayao on one knee near her bench, up on the podium, her 12 players with their gold medals, and they're hugging and crying and kissing and enjoying this triumphant moment. And people forget that coaches don't get a gold medal, and this is the separation between all the preparation and the ultimate climax. And there she was on one knee, looking at her players with the love love that any mother would have for a child that has done so well. And here I was sitting on that comment. How beautiful it would have been if I had tied it all up with, you know, Kay Yao, you know her story on overcoming cancer. When life gives you a kick, make sure it kicks you forward. And I have thought about that so many times. If only I could go back and do just the end of that broadcast again.
Wow. Dick Enberg, the book is called Oh My, 50 Years as a Sportscaster, one of the best in the business. And we'll come back and talk more and get more stories from Dick in a moment as the Paul Harris Show continues on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with Dick Enberg, the legendary sportscaster. Excuse me, I suppose I should say Dr. Dick Enberg. Got a doctorate in health education. You know him from all the years doing NFL games and every major tennis event and the U.S. Open golf tournament and Ryder Cup and World Series and the Olympics and many, many other things, including once an interview in the nude. What was that, about 20 years ago, Dick?
Well, that was 1983, Helsinki, the World Track and Field Championships, and our producer thought it would be a good idea since the sauna is indigenous to the Finns, and I am half Finnish, my dad was a full-blooded Finlander, that we would do one of the interviews in a sauna. And the interview was with one of the medical doctors with a Finnish track and field team, and he was already in the sauna, and our sound man and cameraman and myself came in with our swimming trunks on, and the doctor said, no, I won't do the interview unless you take off your clothes. The sauna is sacred. This isn't just a stage for you to do an interview. If you're going to be in the sauna, you know, take off your clothes. we had to position ourselves. There's a picture there of the book as delicately as we could, putting railings in front of vital parts. But as my wife said, a very narrow one. I don't know what that meant. But anyway, we were in that delicate position, and here on national television. I don't know if too many other sportscasters that have that in their portfolio, that they had to conduct a national interview while in the all together.
Certainly who didn't burn the pictures.
That's right. I don't know where they found it. I thought I had burned them all. Must have been a special copy kept. I got to tell you, share something with you. My co-author, Jim Perry, who pulled all of the information out of me and was just indefatigable in coming to my house with a tape recorder, and I'd be meandering from a Wimbledon story to my farm boy kid days where I went to a one-room school, and then I'd jump off to a World Series and then talk about teaching, and then he had to sort it all out week by week by week with a transcription. Anyway, he called me today, and he says, we got some good news and we got some bad news. He checked on the Barnes & Noble. You can see how your book rates with all the other books that they have.
Yeah.
And he said there's over 50,000 books that are in the biographical category, and we're still in the 180s. And he said, but the bad news is in the news and media section, where there's over 1,100 books, we have moved from number 4 down to number 6. And Hunter Thompson has moved up and taken two of those spots. He said, how's your health? Unfortunately, Hunter Thompson, didn't he commit suicide?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, and he moved right up ahead of us real quickly. So I guess there's hope that this might be a number one book someday.
No. Don't go for that as your career move, Dick. No. There's another part of your career that I need to talk to you about because I was such a fan of it, and I've been a big fan of all the play-by-play stuff that you've done, but I was also a big fan of Sports Challenge in the 70s, the game show that you hosted, which now is back because ESPN Classic has been running some, and I just saw one the other night with, before he was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Lou Alcindor, I guess, was either on one of the teams or was the special mystery guest at the end. Tell me a little bit about the genesis of that, and were you just the host, or were you involved in the questions and producing the show?
Well, as a former college professor, they did ask me to write the questions, and that was an interesting challenge because you didn't want to make the question so hard that the athletes look foolish and no one got the answer correctly. On the other hand, you didn't want to write them so that they were so foolishly easy that the audience thought it was stupid. So, and we would be condescending to those that watch the show. You try to hit the in between. You try to make some of the questions easy so you knew they would get them, and then the backup questions would be a little tougher, and then the mystery guests often decided who won the event. So I was involved in a lot of that. And, of course, as you listen to these, I was the play-by-play announcer. I was doing Jack Dempsey and Gene Tunney heavyweight championship fight, and that was, of course, long before I was born, and we used a filter on a mic to try to make it sound as if it was legitimate and old. And if we didn't have the actual call of a sports event, then I'd go into a studio and recreate it, which was an interesting challenge. But what was exciting about that, that's over 30 years ago, that as a young announcer, we did three shows a day in a Hollywood studio. That meant we needed four teams to have three games, plus three mystery guests. So 15 all-time great athletes would be in our studio at one time. And it was a compliment that even those who lost the first show, if you won, of course, you advanced to the next week or the next show. We taped it about a half hour later. They'd stay around and watch the next two shows. So at the end of the third taping, here would be 15 greats in a green room enjoying a libation together and some food and telling sports stories. And I was privy to be in there and listening to it all. You had Johnny Unitas over here and Bronco Nagurski, and here's Joe Louis and Ted Williams, and they're all talking of various sports of their interest, and you would eavesdrop. It was just fabulous, and we got them all at that time, and this is hard to believe today, Paul, for $1,000 a show.
That was scale for them, $1,000.
That's what they got, $1,000. Can you imagine today? They wouldn't even that's chump change, you know.
No, you could not get major name athletes to show up for $1,000, and they weren't even playing for anything except money for a charity, right?
Yeah, they did get a little bonus, but it was, well, they got another $1,000 if they won their game and played the next week. So they might, if they won three in a row, leave town with $3,000.
Wow. That meant a lot of money. And nowadays, you know, okay, all right, we'll have to give Barry Bonds or Tom Brady or whoever, we'll have to give them $100,000 to get them to show up and do one show. You're absolutely right. I don't think you could do that show today, which is, I think, why it's so fascinating to see him again on ESPN Classic. And of course, the great part of it is to see how many different color sports jackets you could possibly wear. What was that about?
Well, you know, I grew up on a farm, and I had to borrow a sport coat to have my high school senior picture taken. And then suddenly to be cast into this opportunity where each show you got a new sport coat. Well, you know, we were all influenced by the Lindsay Nelson wardrobes of the world, and I figured if I could choose anything I want, how about that plaid? It's got green and orange and black in it. Oh, I love that jacket, and then I had that raspberry jacket, and what happened when I was remarried 22 years ago, I'd go off, and I had all these sport coats in my closet. I'd go off on a trip, and I'd come back, and I'd say to my new wife, where's that leather jacket that I like so much. She's, gee, I don't know what happened to that. What she was doing, every time I went on a road trip, she'd give three or four away until eventually my closet was empty. And I'm saddened by that today because if nothing else, they were so ridiculous that I could donate them to a charitable cause and some fool might even want to give a lot of money for them.
Now, we were talking about not being able to get athletes to do shows like that today. How do you think television and its extreme emphasis on sports, and particularly, I think, too much on the bad boys of sports, has changed the athletes themselves through all these years?
Well, I think the great, great majority of the athletes with whom I deal today are just as good, if not as great, as those that I visited with in my first of my 50 years of broadcasting. The great bulk of those we talk about and those we meet in all sports are terrific chaps. They are role models, and they should be heroes to some, and I'd like to have them as my neighbor. Unfortunately, there's a 5% that earn all the headlines, and it is disturbing that that jurisprudence column in our daily newspaper gets bigger and bigger every day, part of that being that our journalism is much more critical than it was 30 years ago. I mean, the Watergate hangover created a core of reporting where we are more investigative and interrogative. And so we do know more about the athletes. In the old days, you might know a guy was not walking the straight line, but you didn't talk about it in the broadcast booth, nor did the writers. There was something sacred about protecting his privacy. That doesn't exist. So we know maybe sometimes too much, and I think at times it's almost trying to pull the curtains aside in the bedroom window to see what's going on in someone's life, and I don't applaud that at all. Yeah. But that being said, I think that the athlete today is being misrepresented by the proportionate news that covers the bad guys.
Yeah.
And there are too many good guys, and that doesn't make good news.
You've worked with lots of people, analysts sitting next to you. You're the great play-by-play guy. You've worked with all sorts of people. Who's better to have sitting next to you, an ex-player or an ex-coach?
Well, that would depend. There are sometimes... Well, I can go from personal experience. I start with Merlin Olsen in the NFL, and we had 11, 12 great years. And then there was a change at NBC, a new producer, and he wanted to have his own stamp on the broadcasting teams. And he then moved Merlin down a notch and hired Bill Walsh. And Bill Walsh was a fascinating character to work with. On Fridays, he would be as humorous, clever, insightful as anyone you'd ever want to have dinner with. He would have even a question of the week. We were working at the time that the Berlin Wall came down, and his question that week was, all right, the Berlin Wall's coming down. What is it going to be like in Germany 10 years from now? And we'd go around the table, producer, director, and announcers, and we'd all answer, then he'd answer. Next week it would be, there's a woman in all of our lives, not our wife, not anyone that you would have any relationship with other than the fact you really think she's terrific and you enjoy her as a good friend. Who is it and why is that? I mean, he would just really make us all think. Then Saturday would come, and we'd see the practices and talk to the players and coaches, and you could see him tighten up a little more. And then Sunday would arrive, and those blinders would just move right over the sides of his face, and he then became the coach in the game. And if there was a couple of fumbles, it was as if they were tearing the scabs off of all the fumbles his players had had during his coach. He got so inside the game that it was tough for him to have the humor that we saw on Friday or the personal approach that we enjoy from Dan Dierdorf, that we can step away from the action. So Bill had a great difficulty in his 3 years not being the coach, and it's a shame because, in fact, we talked about spiking his coffee on Sunday mornings to try to get him back to the guy we knew on Friday night. So it's a tough answer. I just have enjoyed both, I mean, coaches and players, and I certainly would rather have them as my sidekick than another announcer. I mean, it's brought in the last 30, 40 years so much more insight into our radio and television broadcast that we are hiring ex-coaches and ex-athletes.
The voice of Dick Enberg, so well known for his TV work. Proud to have him here on KMOX today. His book is called Oh My, where he recounts some of these stories and so many more. A terrific book, and we'll talk more about it when we come back with more of the Paul Harris Show after this on News Talk 1120 KMOX.
You're listening to Paul Harris on the voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Talking with Dick Enberg, the book is called Oh My, with a foreword by John McEnroe, and great stories about all his years doing Super Bowls and World Series and Olympics and all the majors of tennis and golf and the Breeders' Cup and the NCAA Final Four. You'll be here the first weekend of April here in St. Louis when the Final Four goes on at the Dome, right?
Right. Jim Nantz and Billy Packer will call the finals, but I have the privilege of doing a couple of essays, which is always fun. And so I'll be around, and of course that brings back memories of St. Louis in 1978 at the Checker Dome, when Dick Enberg, Al McGuire, and Billy Packer called their first national final. Al had won the 77 championship with Marquette and then joined us, Billy Packer and myself, who had worked together a couple of years, and we did the Duke-Kentucky final. Kentucky and Goose Gibbons had that big game, and the Wildcats won the championship. And there's a moment there that tells you a little bit about Al McGuire and how complex and how interesting, fascinating, and, of course, the most unforgettable character that I've ever met, and that's why we devote a chapter to Al. We were, in those days, they had a consolation game, and Billy, who just is a nut for basketball, he would watch five kids playing out on the playground. He stays out and watched Notre Dame was playing somebody in the earlier game, and I was so nervous about doing my first national championship game. Kurt Gowdy, of course, had been the longtime announcer in the finals, and I tried to find a place where I'd be alone, where I could memorize and look at my notes and be really on top of my game, and I found a little room down in the bowels of the Checker Dome, and I went in this room, and I sat down, and I'm studying away, and I hear a little rustling noise, and it's over in the corner, there's Al McGuire. And he's just taking a little cat nap. Here we're going to go on national TV, and Al's taking a snooze.
Wow.
And we started to talk, and I don't know what, for whatever reason, I had just read Saint-Exupéry's Little Prince. And I said to Al, did you ever read The Little Prince? And here are two guys that are about to do a national championship basketball game, and Al is talking about the responsibilities of love and care and the issues and philosophies of the book Little Prince. And I thought, well, if somebody could have seen and heard what we were doing, they would have to believe that this was going on. But that was Al McGuire. He was so totally unpredictable.
And the chapter you write about him in the book is absolutely terrific. Give me another St. Louis memory. If I'm correct, I think you called the last St. Louis Cardinals World Series championship in 82, am I right?
82 against the Milwaukee Brewers, absolutely. And one of the sad memories of that, remember that one game with rain? I think we finished the telecast about 1 o'clock in the morning. But the Cardinals did indeed prevail, and I worked with Joe Garagiola and Tony Kubek, and that was a very fond memory. And back to basketball, I know you have a lot of listeners across the river there in Illinois, and they're pretty excited about that unbeaten Illini team.
Oh, yeah.
And in 1975-76 season, that opened in St. Louis. Remember, UCLA and John Wooden had won in 75, and that was Wooden's last of his 10 titles. And Bobby Knight and Indiana felt that they had the best team, and I think they were right, but they lost Scott May and that injury, and they lost, I think, before getting to the final, I think they lost just in the Elite Eight. And Knight knew he had a great team, and he came back just loaded with talent. And UCLA-Indiana game was put together to start the season, and NBC had just hired me to call the game. And Knight and the Hoosiers just killed poor Gene Bartow, was the new head coach at UCLA, and just crushed them in that game. But we didn't know at the time, but significantly, they went on to beat everybody, and that's the last unbeaten team in college basketball.
And maybe the Illini can copy that.
Well, that's what they're shooting
for.
It's a tough. It's a tough goal, and you know, it when you think about all the great teams since that 75-76 Indiana team, you know, from UNLV to those Houston teams to Kentucky's and Duke's and all the rest, none of them could win the national championship unbeaten. In fact, all of them had at least two losses.
Dick, I could go on talking to you all day long, and I hope that when you are here for the Final Four in a few weeks, we can get together again and share some more stories.
Thank you, Paul, and I'm pleased that you enjoy the book, and looking forward to visiting St. Louis. That's only about a month away, isn't it?
That's right. The book is called Oh My, a great, great history of some of the things that Dick Enberg has seen and done, places and events and all sorts of stuff, and also the people, because there's that terrific connection that he has with everybody that he's worked with. Thank you for your time today, Dick.
All right. All right, Paul. Thank you.
Dick Enberg on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.